You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Why, hello there. You are now listening to the 14th episode of Fly in the Hall, Candid Conversations on Music. This week's guest is Glass Beach. Their music is hard to describe, using elements of punk, emo, jazz, electronic, and more. The first Glass Beach album is extremely layered and varied in a way that leads to an interesting listen. I spoke to Jay and Jonas from the band about making the album, self-releasing it, signing to Run for Cover Records, and more. I really hope you listen to the album and the episode and enjoy them both. So yeah, I guess as far as starting off the podcast, you two could just introduce yourself real quick so listeners can kind of distinguish your voices.
I'm Jonas. I play bass for Glass Beach.
I'm Jay. I play guitar and piano and some other instruments and sing and produce Glass Beach. And do a lot of things for Glass Beach.
Very cool, very cool. So actually the first thing that I wanted to ask about was the album artwork, because I was actually recommended the album by just someone on Twitter. I asked for like, what's some albums this year that you don't feel like enough people are checking out? And they had tweeted Glass Beach, and I was going through all the tweets and kind of judging just based on like band name and album artwork, and yours was one that like really stood out to me. So I'm curious like a little bit more about that.
Well, the artist who painted that, who is my boyfriend, is right over here. Hey, Dax.
You want to talk to him about it? we're talking about the album artwork. Yeah, that's Dax, who, like Jay said, is their boyfriend, and who we like, who was around for pretty much the entire production of the album, and is a very good artist. Yeah, I mean, we like it too. I know that Jay and Dax talked about it, I'm sure, more as it was like being worked on, but as they were like sending us pictures, it just like felt like it was a good visual representation of what the album kind of felt like, which is like great, because people are saying like, I want to live in the album cover, and yeah. I feel that. I would like to live in that world.
Yeah, from pretty early on, I had decided on the color palette for that, and I gave that to Dax, and I had ideas for certain elements I wanted in it, and he kind of drew up a bunch of different designs and came up with that one.
You can talk about it if you want, Dax.
Yeah, basically, I got the color palette from Jay and did a bunch of thumbnails and like tried to figure out the composition of the piece and how I wanted it to look. And I knew what the like vibe and like the mood I was going for was, and I knew it was going to involve like the black sky with the red moon or red sun or whatever. You want to interpret that as
it's both, right?
It's both
canonically.
Yeah. Sun and moon are the same thing. And it was just kind of a matter of the scene on the beach that was gonna unfold there, and that kind of just came together after a few different sketches and a lot of tracing paper and like overlapping these features until I found like a combination that I liked, and then I just kind of like went ham and inked it and painted it and watercolored. Compiled it digitally. It's actually two images. We talk about this a little bit in the documentary that I don't know when
it's coming out next year.
It's gonna come out
early.
Some more visuals for that, so you'll get to see some of the works in progress. But basically, that came together really well.
Yeah,
it was actually the last thing that we needed before the release of the album. It was like literally like midnight on like May 18th or something like that. But it was like music files were all ready to go. Everything was uploaded to all the distribution websites, and Jay was just like, Dax, is there anything I can do to help you get this finished? I'm like, just give me a minute.
But I'm so happy about how it turned out. And I mean, you said Scott, that was what got you to listen to the album, and you are like not at all the first person to tell us that.
So. Yeah, which is, I mean, that's good because yeah. Like, you know, first thing you see.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like part of what kind of stands out to me and also makes sense in line with the music is just kind of like the layers and how kind of, you know, the picture is kind of obscured a little bit. And I feel like there's so many like sounds in the album that it kind of like goes really well. So it made sense once I put the album on too.
Yeah. That was the beauty of it is I got to hear a lot of the songs as they were being produced, I guess, in the room share. And so I was just pretty much listening to the album over and over all the time. And so that really definitely seeped into the artwork itself. I feel like,
yeah,
and you had mentioned the kind of like not quite spur of the moment but kind of like not any like lead into the album and stuff when you released it and I'm curious how that kind of like came about and how you kind of feel about that now, especially considering it was like kind of 3-4 years of like working through meticulously like all these demos and then just to kind of like put it out as soon as the album artwork was done basically.
Yeah, I mean, that, like, we just wanted it out. Like, we had been working on it for so long.
Like, there were a lot of points. I mean, with every individual song, there were a lot of points where it's like, it's done. And then I went back on it. And finishing the album was just a matter of saying, okay, right now I'm going to stop working on it. And I'm going to put out what we have. Because I could have kept working on it for 3 more years, honestly.
It was definitely, I remember it being kind of a surprise to the rest of the band, which was just me and William at the time, because, like, we hadn't really discussed, like, an official release date, and we weren't even expecting to come up with an official release date.
Yeah.
I think Jay told us, like, less than a week before they wanted to put it out, like, hey, I think it's done, I want to put it out now.
Yeah.
And we were like, all right, hell yeah, we're ready for it.
I still, even then, like, after I said it was done, I was, like, still working on the songs until, like, the last minute. There was the song Glass Beach, like, I remixed completely, like, a day before we released the album.
Oh, wow. Nice. Yeah, and I mean, now with the addition of the fourth member and, like, kind of figuring out how the live show is going to come together, it seems like you are kind of still doing that kind of revision. Can you talk a little about like that process of, you know, switching from recording to the live show and everything?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think of it as a song, as long as you continue performing it, is always evolving, and the album version is kind of just a snapshot of like what we think is the ideal version of it at that time. But with adapting them to the live show, we have been making a lot of changes to them. And it's not going to sound, I mean, we know it's not going to sound exactly like the album. We wouldn't be able to make it sound exactly like that unless we had like 20 people on the stage playing 100 different instruments, you know.
Yeah. We use backing tracks, which like fill in a lot of the sounds that we're not performing live.
I mean, a lot of the samples and stuff,
right? It's not everything that is not being played live, but in that way, like we kind of lock into the same structure of every song, and we're generally playing the same parts. But like we basically just like free it up, and it's like if something feels like it's gonna be better live, or if we want to add a thing live, we'll just do that. Like there's like a polyrhythmic clapping section to Yoshi's Island that we only do live.
Yeah.
Because we got the idea after the album was out. So it just like couldn't, you know, we're not going to update the DistroKid.
Yeah.
You were fucking Kanye with that.
I was about to say that too.
Did he do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for the last two, he did that.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's just what he does now. When he puts out music, he's still not done working on it and he'll like patch it. I never want to do that.
No.
Once it's done, I'm going to commit to it. Even if I later think I could have done it better. Like,
then just release it wildly differently.
Yeah. I think a recording is always going to be like a snapshot of like one point in time. And if it evolves past that, that's cool. But, you know, it's just about having the recording be, you know, just reflecting what I think is best at that time.
Yeah, for sure. That makes a lot of sense. And I guess kind of, again, going off that kind of spur of the moment drop, I guess it dropped in May, and then in reference to like a bunch of the stuff I was seeing, it kind of like blew up by word of mouth, or I guess word of typing, around like August or so.
A lot of people on Rate Your Music, I think that was a huge factor. Like, just the something that I've noticed with it is the people who do find out about it like can't shut up about it. So just a few people who happen to stumble upon it, or like friends and friends of friends, and you know, just found it, told everybody about it, and eventually it like reached people who had more of a platform. And that's why it took a few months after to blow up. I mean, I didn't need it to blow up when we put it out. I would have been happy if nobody listened to it, because it was for us. You know,
but we were happy with it, and like, I mean, of course that was something that we all wanted. Like, we were, you know, it just, we weren't setting ourselves up to feel disappointed if it didn't get really any attention outside of the people that we were already expecting to hear it. Which is part of why it was like so exciting when that started happening. Cause like, you know,
I didn't expect it.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. It's funny you said like people who hear it can't shut up about it. Cause I definitely feel like I'm in that camp. And I'm curious about kind of like the way it feels like a very like album oriented album. And so I'm curious about kind of like that process of like kind of fitting all the various pieces together, especially with how broad of a sound there is.
Yeah, it was a puzzle. It was pretty complicated to get everything. I mean, when I think you're right about it being an album. Like, I say that there are musicians who write songs and there are musicians who write albums, and neither is like necessarily better, but I've always considered myself more of an album writer. Mm-hmm. So when we were writing the individual songs, like, we didn't have like the track list, like the track order, like figured out from the beginning, but we did have an idea of like, okay, this should probably go after a slower song, or maybe lead into this song. And we knew Classic J Dies and Goes to Hell Part One was going to be the first song, and we knew Orchids was going to be the last song, like almost from the beginning, like pretty much from when we first wrote those.
So when we say new, we were always open for like, but if we write a song that like will be a better opener, a better closer, we were like open to it. It just never happened. Those just like were locked in there. And like, some of the songs changed like pretty drastically tonally. Like, Dallas was like a different feeling song at different points throughout the production. So like, that was why like the middle of the album was always so like amorphous until we like figured it out. Clubbing was done.
Dallas is an interesting one, especially because some of these songs have kind of like a ship of Theseus situation with them, where I wrote the song and I changed it and I changed that and I changed that and I changed it so much that the final version of the song has absolutely no musical material in common with the first version of it. But the sequencing was really just a matter of like, I would listen to each song, and then when it was over, I was like, okay, what song do I want to hear now? You know, it's very...
Or sometimes even just like, what sound do I want to hear now? And then you would make that sound go into the next song. Because like, this isn't Rat Castle. It goes into... what does Rat Castle go into?
Planetarium,
yeah. And it's just like noise into noise.
Yeah. And there were a few where I planned out like specific direct transitions between them, because I love that. I love when one song just like morphs into another song.
For sure. So, I mean, was it like, once you had kind of like the main parts of the songs, was it kind of like figuring out the transitions in between? Did that kind of like change as you figured out the track listing? Or were the songs like more complete before you saw how they would best be sequenced?
It kind of all happened at the same time, because it was just like pieces here. And like, when Jay said it was a puzzle, that's a really good like way to put it, because like you're doing like a big puzzle and you get a chunk of it that looks like it's in the middle and you realize it's on the right side. But that chunk is mostly good, but then you have to add other parts to that. So yeah, it really all kind of happened around each other.
There would be stuff where it's like, okay, these three songs are really good next to each other, but is that 3, 4, 5, or is that 10, 11, 12, or you know, just putting it together a little bit at a time. I mean, the sequencing came together as the tracks did, like you said.
Gotcha. Cool. And I mean, there's kind of been I've seen a lot of mentions to this being like specifically like a passion project. And you mentioned how like you kind of didn't care what the reception was going to end up being. And I feel like that's something that's kind of like lends itself to the most creative kinds of music. So I'm curious kind of like how, I guess when you don't kind of necessarily have like an audience in mind, like how do you kind of decide which direction to bring stuff in with all the influences you have? How do you like decide how to kind of like layer each thing in?
We just do what we want, honestly. Like, you know, there was really no conscious idea of, okay, we're going to do this big fusion of genres. It's just like, we like this kind of music. We like this kind of music. We like this kind of music. Why would we just choose one to play? You know?
Yeah.
We're just doing what we wanted and put it together in a way that sounded good to us. You know, a lot of it was really, I mean, we deliberated it over like for a while, but it was very intuitive, I think.
I know part of Jay's approach, because like Jay did like, I would say at least 90% of the songwriting on the album, which like so much of that was, like you mentioned, like how do you work all of those influences into like a cohesive thing? And I know a lot of what Jay did was throw all of the ideas in there and then take out the ones that like aren't working best and just kind of carve it.
Oh, yeah.
Because like their song files are out of control and crash.
Yeah, nobody else could could like understand one of my Logic Project files or something, because I'm just really bad at organizing that shit. But also like, I'll have a project file for a song and just throw every idea that I come up with at it, and then take away the ones that I don't think add to it until I just have the best ideas that I've come up with. Yeah. And that's kind of a product of the way that we record, which is that like pretty much as soon as we start writing a song, we start recording it and we keep re-recording it, or you know, just adding stuff to the demos or whatever. So when we're writing a song, when we're thinking about what the chords are going to be, what the lyrics are going to be, we're also thinking about how it's going to be produced, and you know, what other instruments are we going to add, what tones are we going to use, how are we going to EQ everything. Like it's all just baked into each other. It's just from the start.
Yeah, we'll be like, does this guitar part work? Like, probably, because we're going to have it lower in the mix. So, like, everyone's supportive here.
Yeah.
That's really cool how, like you said, kind of, like, all comes together. I feel like that seems, I've never heard kind of something like that before. That seems, like, really unique to Glass Beach.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's the only band I've been involved in that has done it like that.
I mean, this kind of process was just kind of a product of the kind of music I was making before, because I was I was making music solo for a while, and with that, you can't just like, you know, jam on a song like you can with a band. It's like, if you want to jam on an idea, like, you know, you want to try some melodies over the chords. Okay, first you have to record the chords. So as soon as I'd start writing something, I would need to record it so I could start trying pieces together, because I can only play so much at once. You know, and it just made sense to keep using that process when I have a band.
And also, like, the three of us that were Glass Beach were living together for the entire production of the album.
Yeah.
So, like, that also made it easy enough for Jay to, like, bring us in on a lot of those conversations and, like, just record something because we happened to be home that night.
Yeah.
Or just, like, Jay would be working on it. And even if they weren't, like, asking us for input, we would hear it through our bedroom walls. So, like, we'd be able to say, hey, that sounds really fucking good. Here's this idea or whatever.
Yeah. And I'm, like, obsessive about this shit, too. I'm, like, thinking about music 24/7. So there would be a lot of times where we'd just be doing something else. And I'd be like, hey, Jonas, do you think it would be better if we used a E6 chord here instead of a B7?
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, and it sounds like you benefited a lot from like the living together. Did it lead to any kind of like reality show-esque meltdowns or anything?
The only evidence of such a thing is in a video called "Hey, It's Me, Honest Kids." Is the title of the video?
Oh yeah.
Which you can find on YouTube. I think on the Glass Beach YouTube channel, which is not for children. Other than that, no reality-esque shenanigans, I don't think.
Yeah, no, we get along with each other pretty well.
And I mean, we kind of like have been hinting a lot at the kind of various sounds within the album. And I feel like, you know, reading kind of people's feedback, it seems like, you know, whatever kind of music you're into is kind of the parallels that you're going to draw to Glass Beach. Like, I'm more on like the punk and emo side, so I see like kind of those parallels, and then people are more on like the electronic side and or like the jazzy side see those parallels. So like, could you kind of like tell me about some of like the main influences that you had specifically going into it?
Yeah.
I think Jay, say yours, and like if I have any additions, I will. But a lot, there's some crossover.
It's like my influences changed a lot over the process of it, and I feel like that's kind of reflected in the music. Because when I wrote a lot of it, I was deeply into punk, like a lot of the like Jeff Rosenstock, like Pup, like kind of like really melodic but really loud punk. And so a lot of the ideas started as that, but like halfway through it, I got really hardcore into jazz.
But you were also like getting more into like electronic and hip hop music, like over the course of like the production, kinda, yeah. Production side. Like, I don't know if that bled in, but I remember you talking about how like it was the most interestingly produced music that you were seeing done now. And like,
yeah, I'm sure I feel like rap music is like kind of on the, like a cutting edge in a lot of ways. So I do, yeah. I mean, even if the stuff that I make doesn't sound like that, you know, it's part of the melting pot. I also got really into Talking Heads during the making of it. And like, the album Remain in Light was like a huge influence on the sound of it. Cause I feel like that's an album that is able to reconcile a lot of really weird sounds, just like 100 of them at once, and just makes these really cool complex grooves with them. to name a few things.
Yeah. And definitely like I would say, I mean, the if there's like a single artist that most like unified the band's influence, it's probably Jeff Rosenstock.
Definitely.
Who's also like in a way the artist that brought us together. Because there was Jay's profile picture was with Jeff Rosenstock, and somehow, we still don't know exactly how, Jay and William became friends on Facebook. But William saw the profile picture and was like, hey, I don't know who you are, but a cool profile picture. Do you know who I am? And Jay was like, no, I have no idea who you are. And then just started talking. And like, that was right before William and I moved out to California, where Jay needed roommates and wanted to start a band. So it just like, I was already a Casio Dad fan, which was Jay's former project.
Yeah,
and like, that just like, kind of, it all clicked sort of through that. So we can thank Jeff Rosenstock for Glass Beach in a certain way.
I would definitely say that was like the first like music that we were talking about that, you know, mm-hmm. like interest that we had in common. I feel like over the course of making that album and like continuing now, we've kind of been moving more away from like strict punk music. I mean, it depends on how you define what punk is, because some people will be like, punk is an attitude and you don't need distorted guitars to make punk, but
yeah.
I've just like been wanting to branch out more and more.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely makes a lot of sense, especially like as far as like the experimentation and stuff goes. And like in the like Bandcamp like blurb description for the album, you talk about kind of like genrelessness and like the democratization of music and stuff. And yeah. I feel like it's somewhat related the way it seems like in some ways the album's like polarizing, like either you get it and you love it or you're like, I have no idea what the hell's going on.
I give up.
So like, could you expand on that idea of like democratization of music and stuff and just like how it kind of influenced you?
Yeah. So what I was kind of getting at there is I feel like more and more, I mean, I feel like this has been going on for a while, but I really think people are starting to care a lot less about genre with music. And I feel like that's because a lot of the dividers that used to be between different genres are kind of going away. Because it used to be a matter of like, you know, if you lived in, I mean, you'd listen to your local scene or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Or would play it on your local radio.
Like, yeah, like styles of music were very tied to places. They were very tied to identities and stuff. But now, for the most part, people are listening to music on Spotify, like Bandcamp and stuff like that, where there's really no divider between genres. It's just another way of describing the music. And I feel like people are branching out a lot more because music outside of like what they would have listened to before is becoming more accessible to people. And what I was saying about democratization of music is now, like, you don't have, I mean, you don't need a label to get your music to everybody in the world, you know? Any random Bandcamp artist has, like, you know, they have just as much a chance of blowing up as any major label artist. You know, it's just a matter of the right people finding it and sharing it. A lot of the barriers aren't there, you know, and I just feel we kind of embrace the increasing lack of barriers in music, you know?
Yeah, it is, I mean, it's super freeing because we get to say, like, no matter what, we know that we can put this in front of people.
Yeah.
Like, we have access to that, and so we can make what we want, and if it is good, people will like it, and if enough people like it, then they'll, like, share it, and
That's the other thing. Like, the internet is so much easier to find a niche, so, like, whatever weird art you want to make, the, like, even if it's like 20 people who would like it, the 20 people in the world who would like it will find it. You know,
and it'll be great to know that they like it. Like, it's,
yeah,
for sure. It is really cool how, like, you can find those, like, very small communities and kind of, like, find that unifying factor, kind of no matter who or where you are. And you talked about kind of the sort of, like, a relevance of a label as far as, you know, getting your music out there and potentially having, like, an audience of the world. And I'm curious how that factored into, like, your decision, like, signing for Run for Cover and stuff. And
yeah,
we did think a lot about if that was something we wanted to do, and it has been really good for us so far. I mean, I feel like we made the right call because, like, they have given us, I talked a lot about the, like, we can get our music on Spotify, but they can get
it in stores.
Yeah, they can get our music in stores.
Yeah.
They can get, you know, journalists to write about it. You know, they can get us articles and reviews and stuff. Stuff that, like, a lot of the time that is where people hear about music from. Because not everybody has the time to just dig through, like, random artists on Bandcamp or Spotify or whatever. I think a lot of people kind of have people that they look to kind of tell, not to like give them all of their opinions, but to tell them, like, you know, like if there's a certain music critic that has similar taste to you, if they say that something is good, you're more likely to check it out, you know?
Yeah.
And we were like, I mean, we were, it was at least like 2 months, I think, that we were talking about whether or not we wanted to join a label. And at points, like, we were contacted by multiple labels, like, up until the signing. And we just, like, really mulled it all over. Because, like, the thing is, if we just continued on the course that we were on, like, I think Ian Cohen was already interested in writing about us. I think we already were talking to, like, Jimmy Coletta and, like, wanted to work with her. And, like, some of the things that we were doing, we had access to. And, like, our trajectory was still, like, could have been moving upward. And, like, we could have gotten ourselves in stores independently after a time.
Yeah.
But, like, what we kind of discussed was, like, signing with the label now that, like, we feel, like, safe with and feel, like, we can trust is going to fast track all of that, and just, like, help us do it sooner and, like, not have to work our asses off to, like, do it now. And the next album maybe won't take 3 years. It still might, but, like, now it's going to be easier to just, like, make that stuff happen.
It's been nice to, like, offload a lot of the responsibility, because when you're in an independent band, like, you are a manager, you're a promoter, you're Booker, you know, you do every job related to the band, and I don't know how to do a lot of that shit. I mean, I've been able to get by, but you know, I like, my ideal would be to just focus on the music and just, you know, have other people to take care of the other stuff. And Run for Cover has been a great fit. I mean, like, every, like, we haven't had any, like, weird idea that wasn't met with a fuck yeah, so.
Yeah, we have a really fun merch pitch that we're preparing for them I hope they're excited about.
Yeah, I mean, just they, like, what this, like, relationship with this label has meant for us is we can continue doing what we want to do, but with financial backing.
for sure. I mean, and definitely there was no shade in that question, by the way.
Oh, no, I know. I think that's a great question to ask. And, like, I mean, also, like, I at least, like, personally, I think we all probably individually thought a lot about just, like, we are not going to be functioning independently anymore, and that is like moving away from any way that we had made music. Like it was an emotional decision, I think, as much as it was a like fiscal decision or anything like that, because we all in like different ways come from like DIY music and like producing and releasing everything independently and it like being yours. So there is like a fear for me of feeling like we weren't going to have ownership of it or feel like we had ownership of it, but that hasn't happened. Like which is good, because they want their artists to feel good, and artists feel good when they feel like they have control over their stuff. So Run for Cover understands that and like is has not been a detriment to how I feel about our music at all.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah. That's great to hear. That it's like such a good relationship. And I feel like part of what connects me to Glass Beach is kind of like equal parts, or like I enjoy it equally if I'm like zoning out to the music as I am when I like am listening intently and paying attention to like every single detail. So like what is kind of like your ideal like situation for someone to be listening to Glass Beach in?
Again and again. Personally, I mean, yeah, I Jay might have a different answer, but I never thought of it being an ideal situation to listen to it in, but just like however you fucking want
either live at one of our shows, yeah. Or like, I mean, it's kind of meant to be listened to anyway. I mean, I mixed it for headphones, so it sounds best on headphones.
Yeah.
But I also,
I'd appreciate if you use headphones, because most speakers won't let you hear a lot of my bass parts. No, Jay did a good job of bringing it out. Like, I can hear my bass parts on my phone, though, to be fair, they're also just in my brain.
I never want to do a mix where you, like, can't hear the bass. I get so pissed off when I hear a song where you can't hear the bass, even if the bass isn't that.
If you're not doing anything, it's like, I want to know.
There's so many bassists who... There's so many bassists who just play roots and get buried in the mix, and it's like, why is this person even here? What are they? Whatever.
All bassists are wonderful and valid, and we should hear them.
There's nothing wrong with playing the roots. There is a problem with me not being able to hear bass when I listen to this.
No matter what you're playing, we want to hear you.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably speaks to the mixing job that even on my first listen was on a single AirPod at work, and bass lines definitely stuck out to me even with that. So
that's a good point, actually, Jay, because you mixed a lot of stuff left and right. Did you check it for listening to each one on its own?
I didn't do that. I was pretty thorough with testing it, but I did not do that. Maybe
that would be really fun for the next one. Make sure it sounds good on each ear and also in both.
There's a lot of different ways I like to test my mixes, because like I said, I mix it for headphones because that's my preferred way to listen to music, because I get the most detail without any background noise or anything. But I also mixed it to sound good in my car, to sound good on my like monitors, my speakers. And I tried a few different pairs of headphones. So it's meant to be listened to however you want to.
Yeah, for sure. And soon to be on vinyl, which I'm very excited for.
Yeah. So are we. And cassette.
Me too.
No one's talking about the cassette, but they're there.
Yeah. It feels a lot more real to me now, because it's like, you know, we put out this album, but it's online. There's the CDs, but like I feel like once I get one of those vinyls and I can hold the LP in my hands, and it'll feel so much more legit to me.
Yeah. We have like liner art and stuff too.
Oh yeah, the vinyl art. I did the vinyl art with Dax, and I'm super happy with it. I want to share it, but I want people to be surprised when they get it.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited to see that for sure. I know we've been talking about like how many, like kind of how much is going on in the music and like how many layers there are and everything. I'm curious if there's any like kind of standout moments for you, either while like writing or like now that the album's out and you kind of are able to ruminate on it a little more and stuff.
Just like favorite moments on the album?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I might have to think about this
for a minute. I mean, I can, like, so I first heard your question as, like, moments in the production, so I'm going to answer that, and then I hope that that's okay. But, like, I remember one of my favorite moments of, like, a time that I was working on a track with Jay, which also ends up being, like, one of my favorite just sort of, like, production pieces on the album was, which one is the marimbas, Jay?
Dallas?
For Dallas, yeah. Which, like we mentioned, went through so many iterations that were wildly different. And there was a point where that marimba part that like loops throughout pretty much the entire song and is like kind of the like core of it, yeah. I would say, like where it was just like lower in the mix in like a section. And Jay was like running around a lot of ideas, and then we just like had them start with that and then kind of build around it and make that like the focal point. And like that ended up, I mean, obviously becoming the version on the album, and like,
yeah,
which was really cool. Like
the part where the marimba comes in that song, like even though I made it, like surprises me.
Yeah.
I love to surprise people in songwriting, because I mean, like my ADHD brain and shit, like I get bored of songs really easily, and it's so easy for me to be like, okay, verse, chorus, there's just gonna be another chorus, like I already heard the chorus, I don't need to keep listening to this song. So I like to put things in there to trip people up. So like if I'm listening to my song and I'm getting bored, then I'm like, okay, something needs to change here. I want to keep people on their toes. but yeah, favorite moments. It's almost easier for me to talk about the parts that I didn't do, because I really like Jonas's bass line on Bedroom Community. I really like William's drumming at the end of Glass Beach. I mean, throughout Glass Beach, but especially like on the last chorus of it.
Oh,
like,
I love that. I keep wanting to call it the spoken word section, because the earlier version had spoken word over that.
But I took it out because I realized I didn't want to do that.
Yeah. But yeah, I like that whole section is like probably one of my favorite just like pieces of music on the album, I guess. And has been since Jay sent us the first demo of Glass Beach, of the song Glass Beach. It'll be confusing in the next album cycle. Yeah, that was one. Also, like in part one, when like everything comes in.
Oh, when it goes into the verse with the first part. Yeah,
which
I love.
Like a lot of people have like tweeted about, and Jay, like, I mean, Jay has a very succinct explanation of like why it's so good, but a lot of that is like Jay's production, and it's like a simple trick, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a trick that I do there that I do on a lot of songs, because like in like funk music and constructing a funk groove, like the first beat of the measure is the most important, and every instrument has to emphasize that and then can do whatever they want in the rest of the measure. And like the fact that they start together and then kind of come apart is like where a lot of the like catchiness comes from, because there's a, you know, there's a consistency to it, but there's also an inconsistency and the syncopation to it. But I realized that a cool way to emphasize the one of a measure is to have nobody play it. Because like in a way, like a rest is a form of emphasis. And that's what's going on when it switches into the verse. Nothing plays on the one, and then everything comes in a little bit late. So it feels like by the time that it's like it feels like it gets there earlier than you like perceive it.
Well, yeah, you expect like it to hold for four times as long in a certain way, and then it just catches you.
Yeah.
that one always makes me want to shake my knees.
For sure. Yeah, that's a really cool, I don't think I've processed like why that kind of like stood out, but that makes a lot of sense, like
now
the way you explained it. For sure. And you had mentioned earlier that Orchids was always going to be like the end of the album, and I'm curious, is there like significance to like the, like, I think it's like 45-ish seconds of silence, like at the end of that?
Yeah. So the reason why we did that is because it would make the album exactly an hour long.
Yep. Awesome. I don't think there's a longer answer.
I will say that was the original idea, but I do honestly like the effect of having a lot of silence. I mean, it's such a loud song, and then having a little bit of silence there kind of gives you a minute to just reflect on all of what you just heard. Yeah. if you stay there and listen for all of it, you know.
There is definitely part of me that when I hear an album end and the track is still going into silence, I do expect Billy Joe Armstrong to come in singing about jerking off. So far, that's only happened once.
Yeah, I was definitely, the first time I listened to it, I was like definitely looking for that kind of hidden track little mm-hmm. exit.
Well, yeah. Maybe other versions of the record will have that.
I blame Marvel.
Yeah. Last Siege will return.
Nobody expects things to just be over when they say they're over until I something else.
Well, if they didn't actually die and go to hell part one, they came back after the snap.
I noticed like on the website that you released like the stems and the instrumentals of the album. I'm just curious about that because that's not really something that I've seen bands do in the past.
It's not something that's done a lot in the like punk or I don't know, whatever you want to call the scene we're in. Mm-hmm. But I do have a lot of friends who make like electronic music, and that's a pretty common thing to do in electronic music and hip hop music because there's such a big like culture of like remixing and sampling and stuff. And I mean, for like one thing, I'm just really proud of all the different sounds I put in there. And mm-hmm. I figured if anybody's interested, they can just go and listen to all of them by themselves. I wanted people to be able to do remixes or sample it. And I've had a few people send me remixes they did. We had somebody sample our song Dallas in like an emo rap song, and I was very happy about that. Yeah.
Somebody found that and like dropped it into the Discord earlier this week, and they were like, "What is this?" And I was able to tell them what it was.
Yeah.
And that
guy asked me for permission too, which is awesome because I mean, you know, as much as I'm talking about how great the like remix and sampling culture is, there's also a lot of people just kind of sampling things without permission and getting into trouble for that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, it's good to ask permission. Also, we want to know, and like, we want to hear it.
Yeah, and it's also for people to just like learn from too, because there's a lot of times where I'll listen to a song and I'm like, this is really cool, everything that's going on here. Like, I hear like this really cool guitar part, but it's like kind of buried. I wish I could just like hear it on its own and figure out like what, you know, all of these parts are doing to contribute to this whole, you know. There's some cool stuff hidden in there. I mean, I've talked about weird shit that I put in there, but I mean, I can talk about that a bit now if you're interested.
Yeah, for sure. I'd be interested.
I want you to surprise me if you think you can.
Okay, I'm just going to say the things I can think of offhand. There's on Yoshi's Island, there is a synth sound that I made by sampling a sound effect from Pikmin 2 that was coming out of the Wii controller speaker. Like it was like low on battery or the speaker was failing or something, so it was kind of crackly and like bit crushed.
I did notice, but it's still really funny.
Yeah, it's just like this ding sound effect that plays in Pikmin 2. And I sampled it and I figured out what pitch it was and I tuned it and then I played chords with it. That's in Yoshi's Island. Yeah. There's also, also in Yoshi's Island, there was a synth sound where I wanted to get a specific kind of distortion on it, and I tried a lot of things, and I ended up realizing what worked best was to play it through these, like, really shitty old computer speakers with the volume turned up really loud, and just record that. Like, basically doing amp distortion, but with, like 90s computer speakers. God, there's a lot of other stuff.
Yeah. I'm sure. You know, if you listen really closely, you can hear a theremin at the beginning of Neon Glow.
I mean, that's throughout.
No, I know. Nothing particularly comes to mind, though. I'm pretty sure that we talk about some of them in the documentary that comes out in January.
I sampled the sounds of baby rats squeaking.
Yep, you're up.
That's another thing. I just love hiding stuff in there. Like even if nobody's gonna hear it, and if they do, they're not gonna know what it is. Like it just makes me happy to put weird shit in the mix.
I guess the only mixed Easter egg I can think of, and I'm not gonna tell you exactly what it is, but is like the correct answer to what is being yelled at the beginning of Yoshi's Island, which no one knows. No one has.
Well, we're
has
saying like three different things at the
but
same time.
But there is a right answer, and that's what I.
I wonder
what I like.
So I wonder if you can tell if you listen to the Stems.
Well,
I was just thinking that too.
I don't know.
I guess let us know. but don't look into it too hard.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking a lot about Yoshi's Island. I put a lot of stuff in Yoshi's Island. Yeah. Bone Skull, I sampled an elevator as part of
Did
the
you
video.
Now? Okay.
Yeah, I just recorded like myself in an elevator and it made like a sound, and I like looped that, and it's part of the beat towards the end. I mean there's drums there that like we recorded.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we recorded some drums to like a tape machine, not like cassette tape, but like they'd use in old music studios. My brother owns one of those because he's really into like vintage recording, and we recorded that and then just like pulled the tape through manually, like forwards and backwards at different speeds to just get all these
sounds.
It kind of sounds like scratching a record, yeah. just made some weird noises with that. That's my favorite thing to do, just make weird noises and put them in songs. That's the only reason I became a musician. I just wanted to make weird noises.
It's working so far.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, recently the Kickstarter for the Greetings Adventurers like D&D EP / album. I'm just curious a little bit more about that and kind of like just the general like future of Glass Beach too.
Yeah, so that for anyone who isn't familiar, Glass Beach the band is in a band called Roll for Streetwise. It is the four members of Glass Beach with Mike Bachman from the Greetings Adventurers podcast, formerly known as Drunks and Dragons.
Which is a D&D
podcast on the Geekly Inc. network. And it's a podcast that William and I have been a fan of for a few years. There was a while ago, like William and Bachman were DMing because Bachman was looking for a piano player for a live performance at GeeklyCon, which is a like big convention. And that basically unfolded into us doing a $25,000 Kickstarter to fund a 4-track EP and a tour out to the next GeeklyCon. We're going to perform with Bachman live there.
That's in Ohio.
In,
right?
Yeah, it's in Columbus, Ohio. Yeah.
Columbus, Ohio.
So we're going to be going out there next summer, which is super exciting. And it means we get to tour, like, we're going to get to hit all of our home states, because Jay and Lane are from Texas, and William and I are from Minnesota.
Yep.
And we're also getting to record a Nerdcore album with a really cool person, and put that in front of people who will like it. It's super exciting.
And
we
this
like,
isn't going to be, like, any, like, this is going to be some kind of half-assed thing or something. Like,
no,
we are going to write songs that are so good that people would listen to them if they weren't.
It's definitely, it is not going to be the second Glass Beach album, but
it's
think that if you like Glass Beach, it is inevitable that you will like this album, because we're taking kind of the same musical philosophies into writing that.
Yeah,
we're just writing funny songs, it's like weird, and it's
jazzy and complex too.
Yeah.
Like
we do have demos up for that at rollforthreewife.com if you're curious what it might sound like. But yeah, that's it's something we're super excited about.
Yeah. So I mean, we're gonna be doing a lot of touring next year.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. We're gonna be doing that. We've got more music videos coming out, and then next year, I mean, we've got our physical
release is end of January. And yeah, we're
going to be in stores.
It's
I've
in
never
stores.
Made something that's been in stores.
Yeah.
That's so wild to me.
Yeah, I like. It was a great moment for me because. Just sort of like to sort of process where this was going to be at, because I knew that we would be in stores, but I didn't know like to what degree. I was running the Glass Beach Twitter the morning that we announced the label signing and like the vinyl print and the merch and all that stuff. So I was like fielding a lot of replies and stuff. And one person was like asking how they could get a ship to Canada. And I was like able to answer that, but I had to tag Run for Cover to like answer a little bit more. And they were like, oh, it'll be on stores in Canada too. And I was like, it's just going to be on tour in Canada, and like to at least a big enough degree that they can comfortably say to someone who lives just in Canada that it will probably be near them.
Yeah,
and like, of course, it's not going to be in every store, but like, just the, I don't know, it's going to be really cool that our music is going to be that accessible. Yeah, I've never had anything close to that.
And I mean, like, you know, we talked about people wanting to listen to it because they see the cover. Mm-hmm. If they go into a record store and they see the cover 12x12, oh my god, like, what is this?
I want to live in this.
For this week's mid-show shout-out, I want to feature Lead DIY. That stands for Lighting and Epilepsy Awareness Development in DIY. The organization strives to educate venues, bands, fans, and everyone else involved about the effects of strobe lights and other intense lighting on photosensitive audience members. They do this by spreading awareness, providing signage to give the audience a heads up as to how strong the lighting will be, and all that good stuff. You should definitely check them out and consider donating or helping out in another way.
I kind of like to wrap up by asking either for like a piece of advice or an observation or kind of like general philosophy that you have or that you've been thinking about lately, either about like music or about life or kind of whatever you want to get out to the audience.
Everybody who is listening, just like please go out there and just make the like weirdest shit you do. Make the shit that you think is too weird for people, because it is not. Like, there are people who will love it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's
like, the way that I think about it, and Jonas and I, we've talked about this. I like to think about what we do with art as we're gonna do what nobody else would. Just like make the art that we want to do that like nobody else could come up with. And I encourage everybody else to do the same.
Everybody has that thing. Because, we are the only people who can do what we can do. You are the only people who can do what you can do. And you absolutely should if you have any inkling to. And like, make it the best that you can with what you have. But, like, don't feel like there's anything that you have to do to, like, produce it a certain way.
There's no right way to make music. There's no right way to make any kind of art. Like,
the only rule is do. Yeah, as I'm sure Yoda said at some point.
Yeah. Even if just DistroKid is throwing shade at you for the way you're producing your album.
Oh yeah.
DistroKid.
Oh, that's right. You're off Twitter, so you haven't been seeing that.
Yeah, I've been off. I'm glad I've been off Twitter.
Yeah.
They
had a really bad take about music production.
There was something about like. Cool.
Yeah.
I was about to leave on a good note, but I have to talk about this tweet. Okay. There is so much music that is beloved by so many people that is mixed like complete shit.
Yeah.
Just like, you don't have to like spend thousands of dollars. I mean, if you have the money, fucking go for it, but you don't have to. Like,
do what
you can, get it out there. If people hear it and they're like, this is good music, but it's mixed bad, like, you can get. I mean, that's what happened to us. I made a lot of like good music that was mixed really bad, and I kept doing it again and again, and I learned how to do it myself decently. And now like people have heard it, and they've been like, okay, if they can do this for $0, what can they do for, you know, thousands of dollars? just getting it out there is so much more important. You can't like wait to get something that's like perfect and that's going to be polished. And you know, just fucking do it.
Fucking do it, and hang out with other people who are doing it too, because that's the best way I've found to motivate yourself.
And the only reason DistroKid is fucking saying that is because they're constantly like advertising, like, get your music mixed by this guy, get your music mastered by this guy, or this service or whatever.
Yeah.
Don't do that. I mean, because they're not gonna give a shit about your music anyway, and they're not gonna mix it. And I mean, they might mix it well.
They'll mix it well enough to make money off of it, and that's
I think there's so much more room for, like, I mean, even just in mixing, there's so much more room for artistic expression. Like, what is bad mixing today could be like a really new innovative way of mixing like 10 years from now. I mean, you know, it's always a changing art form, and you know, there's no right way. You don't have to spend a shitload of money to make music.
Yeah, and I mean, every classic album is getting remixed and remastered lately anyway, so.
Yeah,
that's what you do. You just make a classic, and then like 20 years later, they'll remaster it. Yeah. That's all you have to do.
There's the advice. Release a shitty classic and come in it in 20 years.
Now that you know all about Glass Beach, go give them a listen. The first Glass Beach album is certainly a journey worth taking. They rule, and you should definitely consider them for your end of the year list. You can pre-order vinyl and merch from Run for Cover Records, and definitely check them out on tour next year. Thanks so much to Jay and Judas for the great conversation. Thank you to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, Michaela Jane Palermo for the artwork, and Kaylin West of Tiny Stills for the theme song. You can follow the show at Fly on the Call Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe and check our socials on Monday for a hint at next week's guest. It's a good one. I'm really excited. Feel free to reach out to me anytime on socials or via email at flyonthecallpod@gmail.com. And I hope you have a great rest of your week. Fly on the call.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.